Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Heart of Healthcare podcast. I'm Hallie Tecco.
And I'm Steve Krause. And every Monday, we bring you the latest in healthcare innovation as we sit down with entrepreneurs and industry experts.
So buckle up and join us as we figure out how to improve healthcare for all. Hello, listeners, and welcome back. I'm Hallie Tecco, and today I'm talking to Susanna Fox. Susanna is the author of the new book, Rebel Health, A Field Guide to the Patient-Led Revolution in Medical Care, which is the culmination of decades of work studying online patient communities. I first met her when she was the associate director of the Pew Research Center, where she was helping publish research about the social impact of the internet on health. She then went on to serve as the chief technology officer for the Department of Health and Human Services under the Obama administration. Susanna, thank you for joining us today.
I'm thrilled to be here. I'm a huge fan of this podcast.
Well, thank you. Let's start with the title of your book. What is the Rebel Health Movement?
Well, I should first give credit to Alexandra Drain, who coined the term Rebel Health and very kindly gave me permission, with some help from lawyers, to use it as the title for my book, because that's the spirit. It captures this idea that there is a revolution happening outside the view of mainstream healthcare that is being led by patients, survivors, and caregivers. And right now, the C-suite of healthcare is leaving half the team on the bench by not paying attention to the innovation that's happening at the bedside. Mm.
And how and when did you first start tracking this phenomenon and really working on understanding what's happening online in patient communities?
I started looking at the social impact of the internet and technology on healthcare back in the year 2000, when actually only about 50% of U.S. adults had access to the internet. Broadband was still not common. Not everybody had a mobile phone. So these were very early days, and the connection that happened between and among people online was the same excitement and energy that people feel today is the same that we started seeing back in the year 2000. However, it was in doing fieldwork among people living with rare diseases that I coined the term peer-to-peer healthcare.
Which, it obviously, peer-to-peer means that you're seeking out, finding, and communicating with those who have similar diseases, and in this case would be rare diseases.
Exactly. Yeah. They have no choice except to go online because they're not likely to find anybody in their town or maybe even in their state who has the same condition. And finding that just in time, someone like you can make all the difference.
Is there sometimes also the desire of more anonymity? So maybe there's someone near you who has the same ailment, but they could go to your church or your kids could go to the same school and you don't necessarily want that sort of connection in person that online gives you just more of the, I don't know if it has to be anonymous, but sometimes just having that anonymity can feel more comforting.
Absolutely. Because we don't always want to be identified with our health conditions or our health worries, right? Like, you know, the idea that what you Google at 2 a.m. would show up at the PTA meeting. No, thank you.
So in your book, which I read on vacation in Costa Rica, such good storytelling. I loved hearing from just so many folks and their lived experiences, but you're able to bucket them and you describe kind of four archetypes that people or patients can bounce between and that these roles really change in your life. And I personally really resonated with the champion, although I've also been a seeker in my own health journey. Can you explain these archetypes to our listeners?
Thank you. And I would put you down as a seeker champion myself. So I'm glad that those two resonate with you. So as a bit of background, when I started writing this book, I wanted to help people step into their power as patients, survivors, and caregivers. I wanted them to see themselves as the powerful actors that they are. And I wanted business leaders, government leaders, philanthropists, funders to also see the power that they hold and that patients hold. So the first group that I identified are seekers. Seekers are people who are not getting answers to their questions. They may not have a diagnosis yet. They just are at sea. And they go on the hunt for information and they do not give up. They are dogged. The second group are networkers. Networkers are people who very naturally congregate with other people. They learn in community. They are the ones who, if they find something that works, they want to share it with everybody they know. And they just can't wait to be part of a community and share. The third group are solvers. These are people who, if they have a device that doesn't work, they can't wait to take it apart and put it back together again, or take it apart just to understand it better. Solvers can also be people who look at a systemic problem and say, I see a way that this could be run better. They're very powerful people. The fourth group are champions. Champions are people who have access to mainstream resources like funding, regulatory guidance. It could be a journalist who has access to the scarce resource of attention. A champion will recognize a patient-led team that has a fantastic idea, and they'll give them the resources that they need to scale it.
I love it. And as I was reading this, I wasn't just thinking about it from my own patient experience, but I think that there's like hidden startup advice in this book and within these archetypes that you outline, because if you are a founder starting a company in healthcare, 9 out of 10 times, it's because you've had your own frustration dealing with something. And we hear over and over again on this podcast from founders who were going along with their lives until tragedy struck, something happened that opened their eyes to how behind we are in healthcare and inspired them to start the healthcare journey as a founder. And so when I was reading through these, I thought, oh my gosh, founders are solvers. They also can be champions, but how can founders also help seekers and networkers? How can they use those archetypes? So for instance, when I think about putting out really great content as a company, right? Being a thought leader in the space that you're working in so that folks can find you when they're up late at night Googling a question, you know, how can they get to your website and learn more about your company? Or as a networker, can you create platforms for your patient population to connect? This book is such a goldmine for them.
I did have founders in mind, and okay, I'm great. So happy to hear that you saw those lessons.
Yeah.
So indeed, if you are a founder of a company and you are very sure that your solution, your idea is the one that people should be using, then yes, you need to make it very easy for seekers to find you. You need to leverage the networkers in your user population so that they know how to brag about your company and they can share what's great about it. And also your product is going to continue to evolve. So you should involve patients and survivors and caregivers who are solvers on your team, because those are the people in your user population, in your customer population, who can't wait to tell you what's wrong with it.
Yes.
So that you can make it better.
Yep. Yep. They should be your beta users. Give them free product in exchange for their feedback. And I think that that's a really great point. One of the ways I like to group the market in general is I like matrices, which after reading your book, I realize you do too. But one of the things I always look at is kind of this matrix where on the x-axis, you have the spectrum of sick to healthy, and on the y, you have the spectrum of motivated to unmotivated. And I like to say that those in the quadrant of sick and motivated are some of our most powerful assets for change in the healthcare system. And that really aligns with what you have built in the Rebel Health Matrix. Can you share that matrix with our listeners?
Yes. And indeed, I do love the 2x2. There, yes. I mean, if something works, just use it. So for the Rebel Health Matrix, imagine a horizontal line, the x-axis, and on one side are needs not met. These are people whose needs are not being met by the mainstream healthcare system. And what's very important is that they get to define whether their needs are met or not. And on the other side are all those people whose needs are being met. The y-axis at the top are all the issues and problems that are visible to mainstream healthcare. And at the very bottom are those who are invisible. And if you can picture that in your mind, that lower left quadrant are where people's needs are not being met and they are invisible to the mainstream healthcare system. I gently call it the quadrant of despair. And it's also a quadrant of opportunity for scientists, for startup founders, for anybody who wants to explore this space where there is such high need and so much opportunity.
Why would they be invisible? What makes a group invisible to the healthcare system?
It could be because of discrimination. Mm-hmm. It could be that their issue may carry some cultural shame. It may be that it's an issue that has historically been ignored. We can put a lot of women's health in that category. I would actually say that infertility for many years was an area where people's needs were not being met. And it was mostly an invisible issue, invisible to the mainstream healthcare system. And thanks to people like you, that has changed. And that's an example of how you can pull yourself up or across out of that quadrant. If somebody is a solver and they are in that quadrant of despair, they might actually invent something. They might come up with a device or a treatment that pulls them over into the quadrant where their needs are being met, but they're still invisible. That's an opportunity for an investor to recognize that someone's figured something out and they need help scaling it so that it can move up where everybody knows about it. It's visible, and everyone who has this issue can get their needs met.
We'll be right back after the break.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
It's incredible how it can be a single person who can move this quadrant for everyone. And there's so many stories in this book and that I know of in this space where you're like, wow, this one person was such an advocate and spent so much time moving the needle for other folks. Like, one that comes to mind is the SynaptiCure team, Sandra and Brian Wallach, who faced ALS at a young age and went through so much disappointment in getting the diagnosis and not seeking care, and then starting this virtual clinic for folks with neurodegenerative diseases that has been just an incredible resource for folks, for other folks like them. I love hearing these stories because they remind you that you're just one person, but you can actually make a difference in this space.
Absolutely. And thank you for bringing up SynaptiCure and IAM-ALS, the two groups that Sandra and Brian have started, because they typify the change that can happen in someone when a family is faced with a life-changing diagnosis. And they brought all of their power and skills, having worked on the Obama campaign together and then in the White House. Sandra's a nonprofit leader and Brian is a lawyer. They brought all of their skills and all of their network along with them to try to change the game for everyone. Something I really admire about them is that they have a part of the IAM-ALS website that's a playbook for other organizations who want to follow their path. And they don't just talk about their success, they talk about their failures, which I think is incredibly important.
Yeah, I love that. And they're not trying to be gatekeepers, winner take all mentality around what they're building, really trying to follow the mantra of a rising tide lifts all boats.
And that's actually a theme that came through in some of the literature that I studied. Eric von Hippel of MIT has studied innovation, user-driven innovation all across the world. And he terms it free innovation, this idea that someone at home might come up with a fantastic invention and they actually don't really care about the patent, or they don't know to care about trying to protect their idea. They want everyone who could benefit to get a hold of this invention. And so they share it freely. And it's actually more common than we think. And that was one of the really heartening things that I found in my research.
It feels like a decade ago, two decades ago, these community groups, peer groups, patient advocates weren't taken seriously. They were not invited to important conferences. We would see entire conferences talk about a specific disease area without a single patient there represented. But that really, at least from my perspective, really feels like that's changing. Do you agree with that? And if so, what has made this change open up within the healthcare system to just take these patients more seriously?
I think it's changed in a few key areas. I don't think that you can now go to a diabetes conference, for example, and not see patient representation. And that changed because of, again, a handful of people. Amy Tenderick is someone that I write about in the book. She is a journalist who at first was able to kind of sneak into those conferences because of her credentials, her press credentials. And that's another example. Use whatever skills and networks you have to break in and take what you need. And in Amy's case, it was the chance to be at these big scientific conferences and ask questions from a patient's perspective. I think that we also see the idea of peer-to-peer healthcare very strongly in areas that have to do with mental health and recovery. So we see it in substance use disorder recovery. We see it in eating disorder recovery. But there are still areas of healthcare where it's a patient's keep out sign on the door. And what I hope is that my book and other voices in the patient-led revolution can show people that this needs to be a partnership. Patient-led does not mean clinician excluded. It means that we need to work with scientists and business leaders, that all of us have insights to share. And it's going to be a competitive advantage to work with patients and survivors and caregivers.
So we want to make sure there's collaboration, but how do we also make sure that it's fair to the patients and that they're compensated for helping companies potentially profit off of their insights?
There is a growing movement to ask for companies to pay patients and caregivers who have expertise. And one company that I admire and don't have any stake in, so I feel very comfortable mentioning them, is Savvy Co-op. What Jen Horan-Jeff has done in founding this company is shine a spotlight on how people with lived experience can be incredibly helpful when coming up with a new product or advising companies about how to create a clinical trial that people will actually want to be part of. And they make sure that those people with lived experience get paid. It's not clear yet how this is all going to shake out, because there is a sense of volunteerism, that when you learn something in a community, you pay it forward by continuing to be part of that community. But we also don't want to see a situation where someone profits or is able to get a patent on an idea that came out of a patient community. That is not fair.
So one thing you mentioned in your book where I was like, oh my gosh, yes, is how we gatekeep information from patients. The best example is research findings. And despite being funded by US taxpayers, so much of it is stuck behind paywalls. And not only is this a disservice to us, but it also leads to more confusion and misinformation. Can you elaborate on that?
Absolutely. The NIH now requires any researcher to publish their work open access after 1 year. So after 1 year of paywall, the American people have access to the information that, by the way, they paid for. And what I want to see is that there be no difference, that we all have access immediately to the best of science. And the reason we want this is not only because of fairness, that if the American people paid for it, they should have immediate access to it, but also because we face a national and international threat of misinformation and disinformation. The more we all have access to scientifically valid information, the better. The more we are able to share it and harness the power of networkers in the patient-led revolution, the better off we will all be.
I agree. I think the challenge with a lot of these journal articles is they are written in a language that is meant for others who are deep into the science and the research. And so I still think they should be open, but I do want to see more organizations like Cochrane, which love to plug them because they are a go-to source for me. They do great literature review of, you know, they'll look at many, many, many papers, because as we in the space know, but the average person might not know, is that a lot of the science that's out there is not replicatable. And sometimes it's flawed. There's small sample sizes, has bias. It's really hard to decipher as a layperson. And so we need more folks that are able to make sense of this in a trusted, non-biased way.
I agree. And I would say that online patient communities are wonderful at leveraging the skill sets of their members. Mm. So there might be 200 people who are part of a certain online community, and four or five of them may have a PhD or a nursing degree or an MD. And those are the people who can interpret those scientific medical journal articles for the rest of the group. What's wonderful about peer-to-peer healthcare and this idea that we can spread information peer-to-peer is that we can spread the information that is science-backed and science-based and continue this cycle that I think once people really understand the power of patient-led and caregiver-led networks, they are going to want to have their journal articles circulating in those groups. Mm,
yes, I love that. And the other thing that these peer-to-peer health groups can do is help generate real-world evidence. And one of the cases that you do talk about specifically around ALS patients organizing an online study where they came to the conclusion that the data reported by the patients over the internet can actually be used to accelerate clinical discovery.
Yeah, I love that study. That was done by members of the platform Patients Like Me. And it was a patient-initiated study that Paul Wicks, who was then the scientific director at Patients Like Me, recognized that patients were going to go ahead and start doing some N-of-1 clinical trials at home based on a very small study which showed promising results that lithium was used to slow the progression of ALS. It was an experimental drug, and often people are desperate for any ray of hope. And so what Paul and his colleagues at Patients Like Me did was help the patients to design a study whereby they were paired. So based on the progression, the current state of their disease, people were paired two by two, like Noah's Ark, and one set said, we'll take lithium, and the other set said, we will not. And they could then see whether the progression of the disease happened or not. And unfortunately, that's a case where the drug did not work, but the platform did. Mm. People all over the world were able to find out very quickly that, unfortunately, at a larger scale, lithium was not shown to slow the progression of ALS.
It's such a cool story. I love that. Patients Like Me was sold to United, right?
Yes.
What has happened since then? Now that it's owned by this behemoth who is not very well liked in our space, how has the platform prevailed or not?
So news update there is that United spun them back out.
Really?
So they're independent again. And I actually had a great conversation with the leadership team. And I think that what they're doing is smart. They're going back to brass tacks and creating the kind of openness platform that the Haywood brothers, Jamie and Ben, created at the beginning. And they are focused on that question of how do we collect real-world evidence, not only for one condition, but across many conditions. And that's smart because so many people in the U.S. and all over the world are dealing with multiple comorbidities, multiple conditions, and Patients Like Me is leveraging their platform to collect that data.
Just going back to what we were saying before, we know we need these sort of collaborations between the large companies that can actually get stuff done and the patients who've traditionally been left out. But again, how do you see us doing that in a way that's just really fair? And do you think that monetary compensation needs to be part of this?
I think monetary compensation has to be part of a public conversation about the future of research, about the future of medical innovation, because for so long, patients were left out of that conversation. I learned in doing my research that the phrase patient-centered came about because The default, of course, was physician-centered, everything centered around physicians. And the same was true in business, and the same is true in drug development. So as we start to move from patient-centered to patient-led, we need to acknowledge that patients and caregivers have fantastic ideas. And yes, they should be part of the design team at the beginning of a research study, not only at the end. And yes, if they are contributing insights, they should be paid.
Awesome. Well, Susanna, I really enjoyed your book, and I'm so excited for our listeners to learn more about Rebel Health and get their copies. And I just wanted to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to The Heart of Healthcare. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the podcast, please leave a rating and review, and don't forget to subscribe. The Heart of Healthcare is produced by Hallie Tecco and Steve Krause. The show is engineered, edited, and mixed by Kyle Moore. Visit our website, heartofhealthcarepodcast.com, for show notes and episode details.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.